From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, actress and social satirist Tracy Ullman. We feature a 1994 interview recorded after she co-starred in Woody Allen's film Bullets Over Broadway and Robert Altman's Ready to Wear. Both films are now on video. Lowell Handler says he's often mistaken for an alcoholic or a drug addict because of his sometimes bizarre-seeming behavior. Handler has Tourette syndrome. He's the narrator of a documentary about people with Tourette syndrome called Twitch and Shout. It will be shown on PBS in July as part of the series POV. We'll feature an interview with Handler. The new film, The Postman, was adapted from a Chilean novel. Critic Maureen Corrigan has seen the film, read the book, and has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A $16 billion spending cuts bill is bogged down in the Senate. Majority Leader Bob Dole pulled the bill from consideration after two Democratic senators stalled action on it. Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone and Illinois Senator Carol Mosley Braun object to cuts in job training and low-income heating aid. The Senate had been pressing to pass the bill before leaving on its 4th of July recess. This may not happen now. The legislation is a compromise rewritten to satisfy President Clinton. He'd vetoed the original bill. A federal appeals court has ruled the government can restrict broadcasts of so-called indecent material. The Federal Communications Commission argued the government has a role in protecting children from certain types of programs. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
The appeals court said radio and television stations can air indecent shows between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. The ruling overturns a lower court decision that had struck down similar FCC time limits on indecent broadcasts. The agency appealed that decision and won. The commission argued the government has a compelling interest in protecting children from offensive or sexual programs, especially those kids whose parents don't supervise their TV viewing. The FCC said allowing indecent shows at night still gives adults the right to watch or hear whatever they want. The National Association of Broadcasters is disappointed by the decision, and so are civil liberties groups. They argued that the time limits are overly broad and deprive adults of certain programs. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
President Clinton wants to ban bullets that go through bulletproof vests like knives through hot butter. Mr. Clinton is announcing a proposal designed to keep so-called cop killer bullets off the streets. Mr. Clinton says his idea is controversial, but he says criminals should not have access to handgun ammunition that goes through protective vests. The German parliament has narrowly approved deployment of Tornado fighter jets to help the newly formed United Nations Rapid Reaction Force in Bosnia. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
In an emotional six-hour debate, most parliamentarians agree Germany should offer cargo planes and a staff field hospital to UN forces in Bosnia. But many opposition leaders strongly oppose the government's request to send fighter jets as well. They argue German military intervention in Bosnia could escalate the conflict for historical reasons. The crews on the Tornado jets will be flying the first combat mission for German troops since World War II. However, members of the conservative government coalition said Germany must start accepting more responsibility on peacekeeping missions launched by its allies. The vote cut across party lines. Some members of the center-left opposition supported the government resolution, arguing Germany must help keep the United Nations forces in Bosnia to avoid even greater bloodshed. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up. This is NPR. Sudan claims that one of its soldiers was killed in another clash with Egyptian troops along their disputed border. NPR's Suni Collin reports from Cairo.
The Sudanese cabinet said the firefight occurred overnight in the Halab Triangle, a mineral-rich area between Egypt and the Sudan along the Red Sea coast. It's also the site of a clash earlier this week that left three Sudanese and three Egyptian troops wounded. Since then, Egypt has expelled 70 Sudanese policemen from four posts along the border. Meanwhile, Sudanese opposition sources reported that a dozen people, including six Sudanese, have been arrested in Ethiopia in connection with this week's attempted assassination on President Hosni Mubarak. Mubarak has identified a Sudanese national, Mohamed Sarraj, as the alleged mastermind of the plot to kill him. The Egyptian leader has threatened to punish the Sudan, despite denials from Khartoum. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The New York Times and the Washington Post are looking at a long paper that the so-called Unabomber wants published. He says it will be a condition for an end to his deadly attacks on people. The terrorist has also sent a copy of the document to Penthouse magazine. The Penthouse group has said it will publish the document, but that's not apparently good enough for the Unabomber. He says the threat is intended to force one of the two papers, which he calls respectable, into publishing his message, along with three annual follow-ups. The Unabomber still says he will only give up attacking people, but reserves the right to destroy whatever he wants, saying that's just sabotage. The Federal Reserve faces more conflicting information on whether to cut interest rates. The government says the gross domestic product grew at a rate of 2.7% in the first quarter of this year. That's the weakest performance in a year and a half. The government also says orders to factories shot up more than 1% in May. That is showing an anticipated recovery after three straight months of decline. Some analysts suggest the Fed doesn't have a great reason to cut interest rates yet. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
I'm Terry Gross, and on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Tracy Ullman. Interviewing her is like interviewing a room full of people. She's constantly slipping in and out of character, and the range of characters she does is quite extraordinary. Ullman was a TV star in England when she moved to the States in the early 80s. In 1987, Fox TV launched her sketch comedy series, The Tracy Ullman Show. Her film credits include Plenty, I Love You to Death, Household Saints, and Bullets Over Broadway. She plays the editor of British Vogue in Robert Altman's latest film, Ready to Wear, about the French fashion shows that attract the international press. Ready to Wear has just come out on home video. I spoke with Tracy Ullman last winter when the film was released theatrically. She told me most of the fashion shows Altman filmed were real, but he told his actors to attend the shows in character.
You know, we were sent out with radio mics on us, and first of all, he sent us out first so that the incredible banks of paparazzi could get their photographs, mainly of Sophie Loren and Kim Basinger. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, uncontrolled media. I mean, I've never been to the Oscars, but I hope to. And I better go one day. And I guess they're all on bleachers and stuff, because you Americans, you know, you're like, hey, get back, buddy. This was unbelievable. It was very frightening. So he sent us out first to deal with the paparazzi, and he said, right, now we're going to go out again, and please leave us alone. And it was really weird to be sort of dressed up as the editor of British Vogue, staring at the real editor of British Vogue across from me, you know, on the runway, who was looking very nervous.
What was the difference between how the real editor was behaving and how you were behaving in that role?
None at all, Terry, because I'm a very convincing actress, you see. There was no... Well, this movie is somewhat farcical. It's sort of farcical documentary. Reminds me very much of Nashville. Altman's film on the country, take on the country and Western world.
Now, our listeners, many of them have also just seen you in Bullets Over Broadway. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you had been writing to Woody Allen for a long time, petitioning him to get a part for you in one of his films. What kind of correspondence did you have with him?
None. I wrote him a very dumb, naive letter, I think, back in the middle 80s when I first came to America and I was pregnant, and I used to sit around the house watching terrible sitcoms and thinking, what am I doing in this country? And then my husband said, what do you mean? You know, watch Woody Allen films. There's a wonderful element here. You know, he's such a snob. And I watched Broadway Danny Rose and just thought, wow. And I wrote a letter saying, hello, I'm British and I live in California right now. And would you like Mia to come and get in my jacuzzi and I could come and help you out with one of your films if she's tired? You know, it was like one of those really dumb letters. Never saw it. But I used to petition more his casting director, Juliet Taylor, because Woody's not an easy guy to get to. And Jeffrey Kurland, his costume designer, I met him once for tea, and he very... kindly gave Woody a videotape of myself. And in 1988, I got a message back via Sam Cohen, the legendary agent, Woody's agent, saying, Woody's got a message for you. He says, it's not a matter of if he'll work with you, it's when. And he wants to tell you that he thinks you're funny from the inside. And I was so... Terry, that's a moment in my career. I mean, I was on my car phone at the time because I was in California. I just had to pull the car over and just, you know, let that moment wash over me. I was so proud. And then he didn't call for 5 years. So it worked eventually.
So how did the experience of being in a Woody Allen film compare with your expectations?
I didn't meet him till I was actually in costume on the set ready for take one. I didn't meet him. Usually you meet a director, you talk to them on the phone at least and say, what would you like me to do in this film? And you meet them at costume fittings and they check out your wig and everything. And I didn't meet him at all. And I thought, maybe I'm being filmed in isolation by a second unit and I won't actually get to be in the main picture at all. I thought, I'm never going to meet him. So it was a little disconcerting, but it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And
did you hit it off with him when you actually met?
I was very, you know, you give him his, I respect him so much, I gave him his space and didn't try and say, hey, Woody, this is funny, right? You know, I didn't push my luck. I sent him some rabbi cards, which I collect.
What, rabbi cards?
You heard of the rabbi cards?
No.
There's a company in Baltimore that distributes some cards called the Torah Personalities. And, I mean, you know, I guess the kids are collecting them and they flip and swap on the temple steps. And they are pictures of all the rabbis. And they're just extraordinary. They're, you know, they're all of these wonderful old rabbis. And I've had the pleasure of passing them on to David Letterman, Mel Brooks, and now Woody Allen. And these guys get a big kick out of it, you know.
When you came to America, did you have to study American so that you could do American characters and so that you could caricature Americans?
I guess I came to America, I got married here in 83, and you can't just get off the plane from England and think you can impersonate Americans, because it's, you have to be a part of the culture. And for a couple of years, I was pregnant, and I just hung around the house and just watched Leave It to Beaver reruns, like I say, and Broadway Danny Rose, and Jim Brooks gave me lots of tapes of, you know, Your Show of Shows, and Ernie Kovacs, and I sort of, you know, really went on an intense learning course and then felt capable to, you know, impersonate you all. And I've lived here for 10 years now and I really do feel a part of it, so I don't feel like an intruder anymore.
You had a very funny HBO special, I guess it was about a year ago, maybe a little more, in which you played, I don't know, a whole lot of roles, including the role of like a Midwestern tourist coming to New York.
Oh, that's right. Takes on New York, yeah.
Yeah, and then you were, you know, like a Jewish mother of the bride.
My favorites. I just love Jews equal funny.
Well, how
New York Jews equal funny. I just love these people. Well, I love being people like Van Rosenthal.
Growing up Catholic in suburban England, suburban London, how did you pick up on what the New York Jewish middle class style was that you picked up in that show, for instance?
I guess I didn't encounter them until I came to New York in the early 80s, and I have a very dear friend called Katie Volk from Baldwin, Long Island, and we went to see Freddie and Betty in Baldwin, and we went to see her parents, you know, and she said, Betty will come to the door, and she'll say, welcome to Baldwin, and she did. She said, welcome to Baldwin, and I just loved them, you know. They were so, after, you know, sometimes British people are so inhibited, and it's so hard to get their true feelings out, and I just love the warmth of the New York Jewish people. They're so upfront, and they impress me enormously. And I'm a parrot, as you can hear, Terry. I'm a mimic, and as soon as I met Betty, I mean, I was going home that night imitating her, and so there you go. And I just love to portray these people.
Tell me more about New York and California types that you've picked up on.
Well, you know, you do that stereotype. I do my stereotype. I'm working on me 12-step program, California Voice. But there is a lot of that there, you know. First impressions are very important. I like the New Yorkers who are transplanted to L.A. that bitch about the place all the time. I miss the seasons. You know, you're sick of hearing that there. Or they come out and they go, I miss the neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. And after 6 months, they're going, my pool guy did not show. And they're soon into the California. There's such a difference between New Yorkers and Los Angeles. And I'd never really seen the middle of the country, I realized, after I'd lived here a few years. And I asked Fox, who, when I did my television show on the Fox Network, I said, you're always sending me to L.A. and New York, and you talk so disparagingly about the people in middle America. I mean, it's... I always remember Joan Rivers putting one hand on one side and pushing her hands in and saying, dumber, 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 dumber about America till her hands met. And so I said, please, would you send me to Toledo, Ohio, and Nashville, and Tennessee? Please send me to meet the real people. And they did. I did a little tour. And I enjoyed it immensely. And I took Polaroids of people and taped their voices. And I've, you know, I have a, so this special tape I can refer to.
My guest is Tracy Ullman. Her latest films are Bullets Over Broadway and Ready to Wear. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tracy Ullman. Now, what were some of the personality types that you picked up on when you were performing in England?
Well, I used to do the same thing in England, really, Terry. I started off as a dancer when I was 16, you know. I'm an old soul. I left school really early and had to get out and make some money. And I used to travel around and take jobs in particular cities because I loved the accents. All the types, really, in England and the types I impersonate in America, too, there's always an analogy. Like, there's the girls in Queens have the same values and expectancies of, like, girls in Manchester. And I find Liverpudlians very akin to New Yorkers.
Could you demonstrate what it is that ties a girl from Manchester?
Like, you know, like the Beatles, they're a bit dead tough like that the whole time, making jokes. And they live in a really hard, tough, cold city. And they're just like all jokers and, you know, oh, please. You know. And I find New Yorkers are just the same. You know, please, honey, don't wear your jewelry in the city. Turn your rings. They're tough people from a tough city with a great sense of humor. Do you know what I'm saying?
Did you grew up in a couple of different places and in a couple of different classes in England?
Yeah, yeah.
Because your father was, I think, very wealthy, but he died when you were six and you kind of dropped down in class and changed neighborhoods afterwards. So did you have different accents when you were young?
Yeah. Yeah, I did jump around, and it's unusual to jump around in England in the class system. Usually you're born into it and that's it. You're stuck. My dad was a Polish immigrant. He came over after the war, so Tracy, he talked like this, you know, it's very, very different. And yeah, when he died when I was six, he made a lot of money. And then he died when I was six, and it was, I know, it didn't last long. And my mother wasn't really accepted in the Polish community to carry on his business. So there you go. There's a difference. So our fortunes came and went, and I did jump around and, having to be adaptable then, I think that's how I got. Because, as I say, you do get stuck in the British class system, and I never let it inhibit me. My husband is very working class, East End London, and he talks like that, and people have called him a barrow boy, and he gets really angry about it. But I just used to impersonate people. I mean, if I was with posh people in England, I'd just start talking like that, like one of Lady Diana's friends. Or talk like that if I go to the East End, do you know what I mean? And there's not many people that can jump around in the class system like that. And so they got very confused by me, and they don't know where I'm from.
So, but when you changed class,
yeah,
did you change accents as well?
Yeah, I mean, when my father died, up to that point, I'd been driving in Volvos and going to Gymkhana's, and we had ponies and things, and it was really brilliant, and we drank orange squash. And then my father died, and we had to go to, like, a public school, and I got beaten up in the playground, so I started talking a bit like that, you know. I soon adapted. Yeah, absolutely I did.
Now, you started in acting school, I believe, when you were 12 years old. How did you know at such a young age that you wanted to perform?
I didn't really. It was, it's the class thing again. Here we go back to this. I was at a state, we call them state schools, the public schools in England, till I was 12. And I was very good in the end of term productions. You know, I was always in the school play and I was always writing plays and amusing the other kids and impressing the teachers. And they said to my mother at the end of a particularly successful show, Tracy should go to a special school. I thought, oh, they mean like a remand home type place. So I was very naughty. So my mother thought, wow, you know, let's try and win a scholarship to one of those fancy places in London, and which indeed I did. And thanks to the socialist government of the time, I got a grant, a full scholarship to go to this place. And I thought it was horrible. It was like, you know, like Fame, that School of Performing Arts in Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't like that. We didn't go into brilliant, unrehearsed dance routines in the hallways and stuff. It was just full of, like, really dumpy, fat, ugly kids or pretty ones that whose parents wanted them to be stars. I mean, the whole thing of making kids act is really ugly. You know, it was like kids saying,
well, I've been in a Barbie commercial, so I don't have to study school work because I'm going to be a star.
And I hated it. I hated it. But it was great because, you know, I was going to a school in London and it was like I was in middle class again.
But weren't you expelled when you were 16?
I was, yeah.
What for?
I just wouldn't take all that crap, Terry. I mean, I used to fight the system. I used to say, this is ridiculous. This isn't what show business is about. And the way that the principal of the school had got this school by winning money in like a lottery in England. She had no idea about show business. Her own kids went to the school. They were constantly given work and put up for auditions, and the competitiveness amongst, like, you know, these 8 to 16 year olds was so ugly. And I used to complain about it. And they, you know, and then I just, when I realized it wasn't no good in complaining, I just used to be in my school uniform next door in the pub playing snooker all day. And they just got rid of me. Rebel, huh?
Were you upset when you were expelled?
My mother was, but the next week I just gathered myself together and went off to Berlin.
To perform?
Yeah, as a dancer, to get my union ticket and to get out in the world. And, you know, I think not get too poignant here, girls that lose their fathers at an early age, I think we're pretty tough. I found that when I've met other kids that have lost their fathers, especially girls, you know. You're just more independent and you get out there and, you know, you do stuff. So that's what I did. Went to Berlin as a dancer with 20 other dancers, I think 14 flaming homosexuals in pink platform boots, who were just the most wonderful guys.
So what kind of dancing?
Was it for musical? It was Gigi. It was a production of Gigi in German. Mm-hmm. So I know Gigi in German. Dunkeben, Verkleine Fee. And I was there for 4 months, and it was an extraordinary experience.
Now, I read something you said, which I wasn't sure whether it was a joke or for real, but you'd said that your mother had wanted you to get a nose job and breast implants when you were younger.
That was a joke.
That was a joke. Okay.
I guess, yeah, that was, no, she's not that type of mom. You know, we're not talking Rose, Mama Rose here. My mother never really pushed me. You know, she liked the fact I went to this stage school, but she wasn't a pushy mom. And she's got a great sense of humor, my mom. And, no, that was a joke.
What did you think of your looks when you were first starting out?
I guess that remark stems from the fact that I felt ugly at 12 years old, being put amongst all those kids, professional kids who were in Barbie commercials, and the blondes got the jobs, and the brunettes like me with the slightly suspect noses got pushed aside. And then I thought, oh, God, is this going to matter later in life? And then luckily I saw that it didn't matter. I remember being in a lineup of kids for a revival of Kismet or something in London they were doing, and they lined us up on the stage, 300 children, and a director stood there, stared at us for like 30 seconds, then said, okay, you step forward, and you. And he pointed right at me. And I stepped forward, and he went, no, not you, dear, the little girl with the blonde hair next to you. And you just don't forget things like that, you know. They treat children far worse than they do adults, actually, in this business.
So were you angry that talent was confused with blonde hair or, yeah, or a pert nose?
Yeah, I just thought, this is what it's all about, right, looking cute. So,
You've played people of all kinds of looks in your sketches. You've played people who are glamorous. You've played people who are very plain. In fact, in playing people who are very plain, I think, have you, like, padded your tummy a little bit to get, like, a little belly?
Oh, yes, I have all sorts of body padding. I have a wonderful costume lady called Jane Rum, who worked with me on the Tracy Ullman Show and just won an Emmy for Takes on New York. And you should see our dressing room. It was amazing. I mean, we had big breasts, smaller breasts. We had like Jewish hips. We had like Guatemalan stomachs. It sounds very racist, but it's true. You know, if you look at the different groups of people, they do have sometimes distinct physical differences. And she's an expert at it, Jane. And my character, Kay, oh, I had the old cellulite legs and bottom, and I had big breasts made out of bird seed, and When we used to be dark on the show for a few months, they used to get stored in a storeroom, and every year we'd come back and Kay's breasts had been eaten by rats. That was always the first thing we did, first day of the new season. New Kay breasts, please! Vermin have attacked them!
Do you ever worry that your characterizations will be interpreted as ethnic stereotypes?
No. Not if you give them enough heart. And when I did play a black lady, which was a big thing to do on the show, and then everyone said, well, look, Eddie Murphy was a white guy recently, why shouldn't Tracy play a black lady? And I eventually did the piece, and I practiced putting on the prosthetic makeup of the black lady during the week, and I drove home from the makeup studio as a black lady in my Range Rover. I thought, if I get stopped now for speeding or something, I've got this black head and the rest of my body is, you know, white. I thought, oh no, it'll just be very hard to explain. So I stopped off at Jim Brooks's house to show him the makeup, and he wouldn't let me in because he couldn't recognise me. And I finally got in and he's like, wow, man, wow. And immediately put on a Whitney Houston album. I said, Jim, please, you know, can we have some Aretha Franklin? And then I went home as a black lady and I just loved it. I mean, to be able to be black for a night. And I was singing and I was like giving my husband a hard time. And eventually I felt like a kid, Terry, because he just said to me, Tracy, that's enough. He was trying to get through me because I was so into my character. Take the makeup off and go to bed. You're not black. You're Tracy. Please, would you just stop it now? You know. So, and when that character went out on the TV, I think a week later I was in Central Park and a couple of great black guys at the zoo there said, well done and thanks. You know, it was great you doing that and it was great fun and I felt really pleased.
Did you do any of the writing for the Tracy Ullman show?
I never had time to sit in on the writing all the time. Of course, my contribution was in coming up with characters and hopefully doing a sketch so well that it could evolve into something else. And there's a lot of ad-libbing and a lot of general discussion, and it was a group effort a lot of the time. But no, I felt sorry for the writers on a TV show because when you finish a season, I mean, I can go on vacation and they just sat there for the next few months writing it again. It's very, very hard.
So would you come up with a character, show it to the writers, and then they'd write a story for that character?
Yeah, they used to wait for me to be in character on a Friday night. And as I say, I would get so absorbed and so carried away. It was almost like talking in tongues. You know, I'd suddenly say, yeah, I'm getting something through now for Summer Storm. Yeah, I guess I have this Hispanic boyfriend and I have like this German shepherd who's like stinking out the place and put that in the next script. And yeah, I waited till I was in character to come up with ideas. It's like, write this down.
Do you miss the mania of doing a weekly show with lots and lots of characters now that you're doing more movies?
I don't miss it yet, I must admit, Terry, because it got awfully hard. It was awfully hard. It was terribly rewarding and a wonderful team of people to work with, but it was really draining sometimes. I really wanted to have another child as well, and I do. I have a 3-year-old now.
It would be very hard to
do a show like that and give enough to my children who are really important to me.
Oh.
Isn't that nice to hear? They're really important to me.
Well, Tracy Ullman, I thank you so much for talking with us. It was really just a pleasure.
Oh, it's lovely to talk to you.
Tracy Ullman, recorded last winter. She co-stars in Robert Altman's film Ready to Wear, which just came out on video. Next year, she will have a new half-hour comedy series on HBO. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Twitch and Shout, a documentary about Tourette's syndrome. We talk with the film's narrator, Lowell Handler. He's a photojournalist who has Tourette's syndrome. PBS will broadcast Twitch and Shout in July as part of its documentary series, POV. The new film, The Postman, is based on a Chilean novel. Critic Maureen Corrigan has seen the film, read the book, and has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has proposed new legislation that would expand federal limits on the manufacture and sale of so-called cop-killer bullets. These are able to penetrate bulletproof vests. Mr. Clinton says current law needs to be updated.
Today, the law is written to ban ammunition based on what it's made of. If it contains certain materials, then it's off the street. Now, that's a good thing, but it's not good enough, because clever people have figured out how to design ammunition made from common materials that do just as much damage. This legislation will change that. It will see to it that we judge ammunition not based on what it's made of, but based on how much harm it can do. That should be the test.
The president proposed his legislation at a local police headquarters in Chicago. Police in Boston have evacuated the State House. State police say an unidentified device was found under the archway of the building today. Officials have cleared the building as a precaution. There's no word on what the device might be. A South Carolina judge is banning microphones and TV cameras from the courtroom in the trial of a South Carolina woman charged with drowning her two young sons. Kathy Merritt of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte.
Circuit Judge William Howard today granted a defense request to ban electronic media from the Susan Smith murder case. Attorneys for the 23-year-old Union, South Carolina woman had argued that allowing TV cameras and microphones in the courtroom would create a media circus and jeopardize her chances of a fair trial. And they said the media coverage might discourage prosecutors from agreeing to a plea bargain. Smith is charged with drowning her two toddler sons last fall by strapping them into her car and letting it roll into a lake. Smith told authorities the boys had been kidnapped. Prosecutors have said they will seek the death penalty in the trial that's scheduled to begin July 10th. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Merritt in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The United States is considering conducting joint research with Vietnam on the health effects of Agent Orange. The U.S. government used the chemical to destroy Vietnamese jungles to find hidden guerrillas. Scientists on a 10-day trip to Vietnam say they could learn a lot there. One member of the team says he'll recommend studies that focus on cancer and reproductive problems. Dr. Arnold Schechter estimates the cost could be $500 million over 10 years. The government says the economy turned in its weakest performance in a year and a half during the first quarter, but a rebound for factory orders in May suggests a modest recovery. The Commerce Department says the gross domestic product expanded at a rate of 2.7% in the first quarter of this year. That rate is considered quite slow. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow gained 5.5 points to end the day at 4,556. This is NPR. 9 people have been located in the rubble of a collapsed department store in Seoul, South Korea. Sophisticated equipment loaned by the United States is helping rescuers in today's work. They'd already found dozens of people alive in the first day of their effort, but more than 24 hours after the accident, they'd just about given up hope of finding any more. The equipment is 4 U.S. seismic sound detectors. They're designed to pick up sounds of people buried alive. The National Urban League says it's determined to play a role in the current debate over affirmative action. During a forum on the subject today in Washington, the group's president called on politicians to focus on economic competitiveness rather than racial division. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Urban League President Hugh Price told a gathering of education and business leaders that affirmative action may be flawed in spots, but he says that's reason to check and repair it, but not abandon it. Price insists that black Americans recognize anxieties being experienced by angry white males.
We only ask that they understand our anxiety, bred of the same economic vulnerability over an even longer stretch of time. Those who are riding the down economic escalator together in this country should stop squabbling among themselves and coalesce to make economic restructuring work better for all of us.
Price says Americans must refuse to allow politicians to pit financially put upon white males against equally put upon minorities and women. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
France says the deposed emir of Qatar is welcome to stay in that country if he wishes. A French foreign ministry spokesman says the ousted emir Sheikh Khalifa is a longtime friend of France and is at home there. He also owns property in France. The emir's son, Sheikh Hamad, took power from his father Tuesday in a bloodless palace coup. His father hasn't been heard from since. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lowell Handler, has been documenting the lives of people who live with the condition he has, Tourette syndrome. It's a genetic neurological disorder which creates involuntary movements, noises, and thoughts. Sometimes the symptoms include uncontrollable swearing and obsessive-compulsive behavior. Handler was diagnosed in 1981 when he was 24 years old and in his last year of college, studying to be a photographer. After the initial emotional upheaval, Handler decided to deal with his condition by documenting it as a photographer. He spent part of 1988 traveling with neurologist Oliver Sacks, taking pictures of people with Tourette syndrome who Dr. Sacks was writing about. Handler is the associate producer and narrator of a documentary about people with Tourette syndrome called Twitch and Shout. It will be shown July 11th on the PBS series POV. The film was produced and directed by Laurel Chaitin. I spoke with Lowell Handler last winter and asked him to describe his symptoms.
I guess I have a lot of different symptoms. I mean, I have a lot of vocal symptoms. I have a lot of noises I make. I have a lot of kind of barking sounds that I make. I have a lot of physical movements, a lot of twisting and turning, a lot of jerky movements of my arms and legs and torso. That's what Tourette is. I mean, it's a movement disorder, and it's a disorder that involves an inability to inhibit, and not only to inhibit movement, but also to inhibit thoughts and words and actions and speech and noises and so forth.
What goes through your mind when you go through one of the twitches, like when you stamp your foot or when you thrust your arm out?
Mm-hmm. What goes through my mind?
Yeah. Are you conscious of what's happening, or is it an involuntary?
Well, it's involuntary. Sometimes I can sense it ahead of time, and sometimes it just jumps out. But what goes through my mind isn't any different than what goes through anybody else's mind. There's no particular thought process. There's no,
I guess I'm wondering this. When you're... arm gets thrust out, or when you stamp your foot, are you thinking, I'm going to stamp my foot now, or are you thinking, oops, I just stamped my foot?
No, neither, really. It just happens. I don't think of myself as really any different than anybody else, except that the only reminder, and it's a constant reminder of how I am different than everybody else, is people's reaction to me. But if there was nobody to react, or for instance, when I'm around a group of people who've known me for many years, there's no difference at all, because they're not reacting, and so I have no mirror.
How much compulsive behavior do you have, and what kind of behavior is that?
The compulsive behavior is one of the most disturbing aspects, I think, of Tourette syndrome. But it's not something that everybody with Tourette has. Certainly, I think a large percentage of people who have Tourette do have it. And that involves, you know, all kinds of things like touching objects, touching people, kicking things, and certain tics or involuntary movements can kind of be, it's kind of difficult sometimes to distinguish what is a tic, an involuntary movement, a manifestation of the Tourette, or what's a sort of compulsive action.
Mm-hmm. Now, I find it interesting, in your movie you say that a lot of people lose their symptoms when they're absorbed in their work, and that with you too, when you're taking pictures, you're not likely to get, you know, the tics and the noises that can interrupt you during the rest of daily life.
Yeah, that's true.
Is there any explanation for that?
I don't know what the scientific explanation is. I think that I'm not sure, really. I really don't know the answer to that. I know that the symptoms just tend to dissipate when one is involved in an activity and they're really concentrating.
So that must make it very appealing to work a lot.
Yes, I like photographing and I like working, and it keeps me happy.
Well, you know, I interviewed your brother.
Yeah, but am I the first Touretter you've ever interviewed?
Yes, you are.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you are. And I interviewed your brother, right. I forget if it was a year or two ago, when he was
Evan.
Doing, yeah, your brother Evan Handler, and he was doing a one-person show in New York about the years that he had leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, he had said that, you know, you, his brother, had Tourette's. And so I made the mistake of thinking that you probably cursed a lot involuntarily, mm-hmm. which some people with Tourette's do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I asked your brother if it was unusual to have you visiting and have you kind of cursing involuntarily in the hospital. And he kind of straightened me out and told me that that wasn't a problem that you had. And you straightened me out more in the movie because only 15% of people with Tourette's have this
right.
problem, which is called coprolalia.
Right.
But, boy, it must be really hard for that 15% of people with Tourette's who do have it.
Yeah, it's actually very difficult, extremely embarrassing, at times dangerous, and also very funny at times. I have a number of friends who have coprolalia, and especially when a lot of racial slurs are involved. There's one friend I have who lives here in New York City. She actually lives in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And she says a lot of racial slurs. And so whenever we're out together, every single, a member of a given ethnicity will pass by, and she will come out with the racial slur for that particular ethnic group, including her own and mine and anybody else's. So it can be very, very, very interesting going around town with her.
Well, you know, I think some people interpret that as, you know, well, this is what she's really thinking. Somebody else who thought that we would be able to, like, repress it to keep it in, but because she has this neurological disorder, it comes out. But she really believes these racial epithets.
Well, I think, you know what it is? I'll give you an example that I think people can kind of grasp and understand.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you been walking down the street and seen somebody totally bald and thought to yourself, baldy? Or seen somebody who weighs like 400 pounds and thought, fatso? These things pop into everybody's mind, but how many people would actually blurt them out?
But that's my point.
Thinks of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, she thinks of the word because, you know, a lot of people would think of the word. It doesn't mean that she's against the person or that she's a racist or that she's a bigot at all. But yet the word is in the culture. It's out there. And it's already been established as a sort of label in society. So she simply has the inability to inhibit this language.
My guest is Lowell Handler. He's the narrator of a film about people with Tourette syndrome called Twitch and Shout, which will be shown July 11th on PBS. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Talking about Tourette syndrome with Lowell Handler. Do you remember the first time you met somebody else who had Tourette's?
Yes, I remember that vividly, and it was very frightening for me.
Why was it frightening? I thought you were going to say the opposite.
No, actually, it was frightening because I had, you know, somewhat middle-of-the-road symptoms, and I remember I went to a Tourette Syndrome Association meeting in New York City, which is where I live now. And I went with my parents. And I remember it was very difficult for my parents, too, because here was this thing that you have that, and we really didn't know what to expect. And there was a man there who actually I'm still in touch with, a man named Bob Nast, who lives in New Jersey. And he had some very, he's a very nice guy and he's a very intelligent man. And he had some very kind of classically severe symptoms, and he came over and introduced himself and shook my hand, said hello, and he was like, you know, mouth popping and flailing and all over the place, and I'm saying to myself, holy God, you know, is this going to happen to me, or, you know, what, you know, who knows, you know, Tourette is not degenerative. That's the first thing everybody asks, is it degenerative? It's not degenerative, but it's constantly in a fluctuating state. Sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better. It waxes and wanes, and it changes every day and every week, and you really don't know what to expect. So it was frightening for me, but then now I don't even give a damn anymore, really. But it just, I didn't know what to expect. It was that kind of thing.
Does anyone on the street ever assume that you're homeless because you're walking funny or because you're talking to yourself?
I think they don't think I'm homeless because of the way I'm dressed.
Right.
But I think they do think, I've had many times people react where they think I'm an alcoholic or I'm a drug addict. The other day I was in my neighborhood in the East Village, and one of the actually homeless guys who was panhandling, I was buying a New York Times on the corner, and he looked at me, and I was kind of barking and doing that, and he looked at me and said, "You've been drinking that vodka again, huh, buddy?" And I said, "No, have you?" You know, I mean, what am I supposed to say? But it's like everybody has some comment. Everybody wants to put in their two cents.
Part of your film is set at a national conference for people with Tourette syndrome.
Tourette's Conference.
Yeah, and it looks like a really interesting conference, and several of the people attending comment about how it's the place where they feel most comfortable in the world because everyone at the conference has Tourette's and you don't have to explain yourself. The hotel staff understands what's going on, and so you don't have to be self-conscious about anything. Do you feel that way there, too?
Oh, definitely, yeah. And in fact, Oliver Sacks was there with us.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like our unofficial mascot. it was a lot of fun. I mean, those conferences are incredibly exhausting and rejuvenating at the same time.
There was one discussion at the conference about the difficulty of finding a lover or a spouse. Is it usually hard for people with Tourette's to find somebody that they feel really comfortable with and who feels comfortable with them? I'm wondering, too, if you know a lot of couples who both have the syndrome.
Well, actually, you know, I think it is more difficult for people with Tourette or with any particular condition just because it's an added difficulty. A couple of years ago, both Laurel Chaitin, the director of this film, and myself were at a wedding. And the wedding was two people who both have Tourette syndrome. And it was quite incredible. It really was, because the man actually had a severe case of Tourette syndrome, and the woman had a mild case of Tourette syndrome. And there was a rabbi conducting the service, and every single thing that was said as part of the ceremony, there was some response by the groom in relation to what was being said, so that the rabbi would say, we all look forward to these things in life, being together, and the things that we look forward to. And the groom yelled out, "Grateful Dead tapes, Grateful Dead tapes." And then he said, we've so thankful to the Tourette Syndrome Association for bringing these people together, and they've given so much. And he said, like, money, money. And you know, all kinds of hysterical things like that. And everything was like almost like a comedy routine, you know?
When we decided to do this interview, I, of course, wondered, you know, what if any symptoms would come out while we were talking? You know, would you be twitching as we talked? And you know, would there be noises being made? And now you're in a studio in a separate city from me. We're talking via fiber optic line. So you're in New York, I'm Philadelphia. I haven't seen you. But there's been a couple of times when I heard, I thought a little shout or something.
Right.
But really, I mean, nothing has, on the whole, sounded different than a typical interview. Do things usually go that uninterrupted for you? Is it because, like, you're particularly focusing on the interview?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you're disappointed.
No.
It is because I'm sort of focused, but it's also because I think my Tourette is highly visual, and I think that, you know, it also tends to be very interactive, where I'm interacting with other people, so that I'm very animated and I kind of move around a lot. But when I'm kind of concentrated and asked to be contained in a setting, like in a studio like this, in a sound studio or on a train or a bus, I tend to try to keep to myself and just focus on the task at hand, yeah.
Your movie is called Twitch and Shout, which I really like the title because it's funny. And I'm wondering if you and a lot of people you know with Tourette syndrome have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, we definitely do. I think it's both, you know, it's a full range of things. It's very terrible, it's uncomfortable, it's awful, but it's also quite hysterical and quite funny. And I think it's all of those things at the same time.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Lowell Handler is the narrator and associate producer of the film Twitch and Shout, which will be shown July 11th on the PBS series POV. He's now at work on a book with the working title A Tourette's Tale. Our interview was recorded last winter. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about the vice president's mission to Moscow, also about Bosnia, what the French have to say about the UN mission there and what the Germans have done most recently. Also, we'll be talking with three editorial cartoonists about their craft and the state of the business. And we'll be talking with the great British jazz singer Cleo Lane and her husband, clarinetist John Dankworth, who've been touring North America in recent months.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The poetry of the Nobel Prize-winning Chilean poet Pablo Neruda echoes throughout the newly released Italian movie The Postman, which explores the power of art to inspire friendship as well as hate. The Postman was adapted from Chilean writer Antonio Skármeta's 1987 novel Burning Patience. To coincide with the American opening of the film, Miramax Books has just republished that novel under the new title, The Postman, along with a selection of Neruda's love poetry heard in the film. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Massimo Troisi, the 41-year-old Italian actor who played the lead in the new movie, The Postman, died the day after filming was completed. Troisi knew at the start of the project that he was a very sick man. In fact, he needed a heart transplant. But Troisi was so committed to the movie that he postponed the operation. After all, he had discovered Antonio Skármeta's novel and worked on the screenplay. The illness evident in Troisi's haggard face throughout the movie gives a melancholy dimension to the character of Mario, the ordinary postman who yearns for a life of love, poetry, and politics. The movie is amazing, but if you go back and read the novel of The Postman, you understand even better how this powerful story about the pleasures and risks of committing oneself to one's dreams might have made Troisi feel that taking such an incredible gamble with his own life was worthwhile. Skármeta's short novel opens in a remote seaside village in Chile in 1969. 17-year-old Mario is the village oddball because he doesn't want to be a fisherman. Serendipity strikes when the local post office advertises for someone to deliver mail to an offshore island that's home to only one literate resident, the great poet Pablo Neruda. At first, Neruda, despite his avowed Marxist affinity for the common people, responds to Mario's stumbling attempts at conversation with aloofness. After Mario quizzes him one day about metaphors, Neruda announces that he's retreating to his kitchen to prepare an aspirin sandwich. But Neruda comes to recognize Mario as a fellow dreamer, and the two develop a tender friendship. Mario even appropriates some of his mentor's love poetry to seduce a young barmaid. When Neruda accuses Mario of plagiarism, Mario nimbly defends himself by invoking the democratic idealism he learned from Neruda. Poetry, Mario declares, belongs to those who use it, not those who write it. One of the great charms of The Postman is the way it gives readers a non-academic lesson in understanding how poetry works. For instance, when Neruda leaves to become Chile's ambassador to France, Mario, at his request, tapes the sounds of the island, the flapping of pelicans' wings, the click of crabs' claws, the heartbeat of his and the barmaid's unborn child. Neruda wants a remembrance of his homeland, but he's also teaching Mario, who's not too adept at writing verse, another way to create poetry through the tape recording. Yet even as it celebrates the aesthetic wonder of poetry, Skarmata's novel, more so than the movie, recognizes that art's anarchic way of viewing the world threatens those people bent on enforcing conformity. The novel ends in 1973 as a right-wing military dictatorship topples the socialist Allende government in Chile. Neruda, as he did in real life, dies 12 days after the coup and so is spared any retribution. But his disciple Mario, who's absorbed Neruda's politics along with his poetry, is left to pay the price for being a free thinker. This is the summer we're supposed to be thankful that Clint Eastwood alchemized another novella, The Bridges of Madison County, into an adequate movie by draining away the book's awful pseudo-poetry. No such miracle is required in the case of The Postman. Without an ounce of the sleazy sentimentality that is the smile-button veneer masking American culture's more violent impulses, The Postman lifts your spirits and breaks your heart.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed the novel The Postman by Antonio Skarmata. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Our program was directed today by Alan Tu. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.